From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Former Vice President Al Gore's new book is called Our Choice, A Plan to Solve the Climate Crisis. At the end of the book, Gore writes a hypothetical, optimistic history of an upcoming event. In December of 2009, as he describes it, all the nations of the world gathered in Copenhagen, Denmark, to negotiate a global treaty that many even then thought was impossible. Later it was strengthened. And in 2010, an idealistic new generation took the initiative and changed the political tone in nation after nation. Well, Al Gore joins us now from Philadelphia. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. Good to be back.
And let's begin by contrasting your hopeful reflection from the future back on December 2009 with what's in the news every day, which is one warning after another that next month's Copenhagen conference will fail to achieve any meaningful agreement on climate change. What are we missing?
Well, I think that we are on track with somewhat lowered expectations to achieve, nonetheless, a binding political agreement. Much depends on the amount of progress that can be made in the Senate between now and the middle of December, when the heads of delegations and heads of state will be in Copenhagen. But the consensus legislation now being prepared in the Senate does have a prospect of attracting 60 votes, and I think that President Obama will have a strengthened hand, having already passed legislation in the House and having the clear prospect of legislation in the Senate and a binding regulation on the books from EPA this year requiring reductions in CO2, even if legislation were not to pass.
Do you assume that President Obama will go to Copenhagen to negotiate
that? I hope that he will.
Why? What's important about him going there?
Well, the United States is still the acknowledged leader of the world, and we have the largest economy in the world, and we're one of the two largest emitters of global warming pollution. And unless the United States plays its customary leadership role, it would be impossible for the world to resolve this crisis. But with the United States leading in a responsible way, we can.
Your personal finances recently made the front page of the New York Times. You've been criticized for investing in companies that, say, would bid on contracts in a cap-and-trade system. You stand accused of doing well by doing good. Would you benefit financially from, say, the creation of a cap-and-trade system?
Well, I've given away everything and more that's attributable to anything of that sort. The majority of my business career over the last 9 years since I left public service has been focused on other areas, internet, information technology, media, and the like. But I have made some investments in the things that I believe in. If I were not to do so, I would be accused by these same people of being a hypocrite. I have donated all of that and more to the Alliance for Climate Protection, a nonprofit that focuses on raising awareness of the climate crisis and the solutions to the same.
Now, you start Our Choice by addressing a very basic problem, which is population growth. And you've spoken and written about how population growth is projected to stabilize as women gain more autonomy, more control over childbearing, and indeed they stop having very large families. I can't get over this contradiction in my mind, though, that doesn't that very process, this revolutionary change of going from big, typically rural families to much smaller, often urban families, typically come from the very carbon-producing and emitting economic growth that you're trying to curtail?
Well, no. The scientists used to think that, the social scientists did, but they discovered after decades of study that actually that was masking the true factors that are bringing about this change. The factors that are producing that change in every nation in the world are the education of girls, the empowerment of women to participate in decisions, the ability to manage the number of children and the spacing of children, and most importantly, higher child survival rates. Because when parents have a high level of confidence that their children will survive, the natural preference for smaller families takes hold. We've gone through that transition in the United States, Western Europe, Japan, but the developing countries are now well along that journey.
But I was thinking, for example, of a couple I met in Chengdu in Sichuan province in China last year, These are no incidental players in the entire question of climate change. They're moving into a modern, urban, two-bedroom apartment with all the modern appliances. They'll have only one kid, as it's national policy. But I couldn't get over the thought that they'll probably consume more and have a bigger carbon footprint than a dozen rural Chinese rice farmers. They're so much more engaged in the developed economy now.
Well, that is sometimes the case. But in developed countries and elsewhere, in many other places, actually an urban lifestyle can be much more energy efficient. But it depends upon the technologies we use. It depends upon the design of our cities. By shifting toward electric cars and efficient and enjoyable mass transit and much more energy efficient appliances and equipment, we can squeeze a huge percentage of the energy we think we're using now but is actually wasted out of that waste category and improve our standard of living as we reduce the global warming pollution and the wasted energy.
I'm reminded of when we spoke on this program, when you wrote Earth in the Balance, which must have been, I assume, 1992.
January of 1992, that's right.
And I think back on what has happened since. The global environmental movement has grown phenomenally. Public consciousness has grown incredibly. But apart from our arresting ozone depletion, we don't seem to have put a dent in global warming. We don't seem to have actually moved forward during the very time that millions and millions more people have taken on board an ideal of environmental action.
Well, we have made some progress, but the burning of fossil fuels and the rapid deforestation underway in many countries, particularly tropical countries, has moved ahead much faster. We're now at the point where we have to make a choice, hence the title, Our Choice, mm-hmm. in a determined way, shift to renewable sources of energy, much higher levels of efficiency, and sustainable forestry and sustainable agriculture. In writing this book over the last 3.5 years, I came to the conclusion that we have all the tools we need to solve 3 or 4 climate crises, and we only have to solve one, but we have to choose to do it.
Al Gore, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Well, thank you, Robert.
Al Gore's latest book is called Our Choice, A Plan to Solve the Climate Crisis.
The Chesapeake Bay is where we go next. It's America's largest estuary, and it has undergone decades of cleanup efforts at a cost of billions of dollars. Yet it remains heavily polluted. So today, the Environmental Protection Agency is scheduled to announce a new draft of a plan as it tries yet again to save the bay. Scientists are still working on this plan. NPR's Christopher Joyce recently hopped aboard the research ship Rachel Carson to see what progress they're making.
Dave Namazi steers a 15-foot skiff through the choppy waters of the Wye River, one of the bay's numerous tributaries. On shore, soybean and cornfields give way to housing developments. Namazi is with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. He says 30 years ago, people knew the bay was sick.
But I think there was also really a sense that, in a few years, some hard work, we'll get over this. And we've learned both in practice, but also just living on the bay, that's certainly not the case.
Some things are better. Striped bass are back in big numbers. Several rivers, like the Potomac, are cleaner. But there are more dead zones, where almost nothing lives. Seagrasses are struggling, and once great harvests of oysters and crabs are a memory. The EPA has now vowed to start over, to do better. But scientists first have to figure out what's actually happening in and especially under the water. That's what determines the bay's basic chemistry.
We've been basically making a map of what the sediments are doing to the water in Chesapeake Bay.
That's Walter Boynton, a marine scientist also with the Science Center. He's aboard the Rachel Carson taking sediment cores. The crew lowers a metal canister into the murky water where it sinks to the bottom and grabs a mud sample. Then it's hauled back on board and its contents retrieved.
There it goes.
These piles of glop are like biopsies. They indicate where the bay is healthy and where it's dying. That will help determine where the EPA needs to crack down on pollutants. Boynton says dead sediments are easy to identify.
They almost feel like if you were making a pot of Jell-O and it hasn't quite congealed yet.
Dead sediments are basically mud with little or no oxygen. Clams and worms and microscopic plants at the bottom of the food chain, down in the mud, need that oxygen. But the bay is oxygen-starved. What it's got instead are nitrogen and phosphorus, way too much of it. The extra nitrogen and phosphorus come mostly from sewage, cars, and fertilizer. They act as nutrients for algae, which gorge on them and grow into huge floating blooms. When the algae die and decompose, that sucks oxygen out of the water, and that's deadly.
The key issue in the Bay program is reduce the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and dirt getting into the bay. We frankly need to know, where does this stuff come from? How long does it hang out here? And where the heck does it go?
Biologist Kristen Politano taps a canister of sediment to get oxygen bubbles to rise. She learned about nutrient pollution in Florida, but in some ways it's just the same here. Scientists can map the pollution hotspots, but someone has to follow them back to the source to fix the problem.
I mean, people get upset about what's going on in the bay, but they have to realize a lot of these problems are coming from the upper watersheds themselves. You have to look at restoring headwater streams and rivers and things like that before you're going to see an improvement in the water quality that's coming into the bay.
Once Boynton measures the oxygen and nutrients in these sediments, the information goes into computer models that EPA can use to figure out where, within this 180-mile-long bay, it needs to spend its new cleanup money and where to crack down on polluters. Like most scientists who've studied the bay, Boynton says progress has been frustratingly slow, but he's optimistic about this new start.
I still maintain that if we start seeing big changes in nutrient loads, we will see positive changes in the bay very quickly, and by very quickly I mean a year or two.
Making that happen, he adds, is up to politicians and the people who vote for them. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And you can take a virtual voyage with a team of Chesapeake Bay researchers and see just how messy their job can be at NPR.org.
Scientists studying a crevasse in the Ethiopian desert say we may be witnessing the birth of a future ocean. In 2005, a 35-mile-long rift broke open as two parts of the African continent separated. Researchers from several countries have confirmed that the volcanic processes at work beneath the Ethiopian rift are nearly identical to those at the bottom of the world's oceans. They say it's likely the beginning of a new sea. Joining us to talk about this is Cindy Ebinger, professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, and she joins us from NPR member station WXXI. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How long have you been studying this rift in the Ethiopian desert?
At the start of this recent activity that started in September 2005, I had actually been doing work with scientists in Ethiopia, most notably Atalay Ayeli and Gezahay Nyurgu. And we had been looking at the area and making some predictions, and then the earthquake sequences started. And I came a little bit afterward and put in some seismometers so we could just record then the activity and try and actually track the magma movement.
Now, can you explain exactly how that happens? What exactly is happening with the volcanic magma?
Well, in this area, Africa and Arabia are splitting apart, and it's not just one straight line. There's actually two parallel zones, and they're about 2 or 3 miles wide. And in this case, then, the plates are being pulled apart. But underneath, there are little bits of molten rock that are moving upward, and they're accumulating quite deep down, maybe 10 miles down below the surface. That's the part that we still don't understand completely. But subsequent to that, we've had 12 additional periods where big, long sheets of magma have risen up and cracked open the rocks lying above, so really creating this new ocean floor.
Mm. Why is this so unusual?
It's actually not an unusual process in terms of Earth history. this process is happening along mid-ocean ridges worldwide. But by the time a ship is mobilized, we may have missed all of this activity. Here, this is one of the few places on the surface of the Earth right now where we have this process occurring. So it's a unique study location.
Yeah, you can see it happening.
Yes, we can.
So when do you think there will be a new ocean?
Buying oceanfront property in the Afar Desert is a bit premature. Maybe in another 100,000 years or 500,000 years, it would be the ocean will be there.
Cindy Ebinger is a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, and she joined us from NPR member station WXXI. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The health of the planet will top the agenda in Copenhagen next month at a meeting of environmental officials from around the world. Organizers hope to hammer out a major new treaty to fight global warming. This past week, negotiators met in Barcelona for the final proceedings before the Copenhagen event. And as NPR's Richard Harris reports, the rift between the United States and some of the world's poorest nations grew even wider.
Every nation will eventually have to take action to address climate change. The fight now is who does what when. At a news conference in Barcelona, U.S. diplomat Jonathan Pershing laid out what the United States wants to happen. The rich industrial nations will recommit to reducing their emissions. Meanwhile, major developing countries will have to slow down the rate at which their emissions are growing.
China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, many, many others are beginning to outline their domestic efforts to do just this.
The world's poorest countries, like Niger and Côte d'Ivoire, won't have to cut emissions at all, but they will need to start figuring out how they can develop with clean energy. Under the deal Pershing envisions, rich countries will help them to do that. As part of this package, the United States wants all countries, rich and poor, to agree to let the world review and judge their plans. And this is where the rift between rich and poor appears. Pershing says the developing world won't agree to submit formal plans for other nations to see.
They would like us to make binding commitments on finance, binding commitments on emissions targets, and they are not even prepared to take a review obligation, much less make it binding.
This refusal stems from a deal that was negotiated long ago. Under the Kyoto Climate Treaty of 1997, developing countries were given a free pass on all obligations, and they're loath to give that up.
The developing countries in particular would like a legal deal that applies to us but not to them. And we are not prepared to have such an agreement.
The developing countries naturally have a different take on all of this. They point out that the United States and Europe are responsible for most of the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so the poor nations say it's the job of the rich nations to fix the problem. Martin Kaur runs the South Center, which is a research group funded by the developing world. He says poor nations want the rich to slash emissions by a dramatic 40% in the next decade, and even the most ambitious promises come nowhere close.
So the developing countries are aghast, that's the word, aghast, astonished at such a low level of commitment.
Another part of the rift is over money. Poor countries say they need a huge amount of money to deal with climate change, much more than is on the table. They're asking for at least 1% of the rich country's gross domestic product.
1% of GNP is $400 billion to 5% of GNP. This is the proposal of the Africa Group.
At one point this week, African nations walked out of the talks to press their demands. Eventually, they went back in, but the rift persists. Jake Schmidt from the Natural Resources Defense Council says part of this is a negotiating tactic. Poor nations may eventually agree to develop plans and let the world review them, but they're not prepared to say so just yet.
I'm not surprised that they won't budge on that until they know exactly what the U.S. is going to do.
And the U.S. isn't quite sure itself what it will put on the table in Copenhagen. Any deal will need to be ratified with 67 votes in the U.S. Senate, and it's not yet clear how far the Senate will go on climate commitments. U.S. diplomats don't want to cut a deal in Copenhagen that will be a dead letter in Washington. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Chesapeake Bay is the nation's largest estuary, and it's in poor health. That's despite decades of promises to clean it up. Today, the federal government announced the outlines of a new effort to help restore the bay. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
The bay is in trouble largely because it's being overwhelmed with nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediments from agricultural runoff, as well as from the 17 million people who live in the bay's watershed. One of the biggest victims of this has been the bay's once-thriving oysters. In a telephone news conference, Peyton Robertson from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said restoring the oysters is key to the new bay recovery effort.
We want to coordinate with Maryland, Virginia, and the Potomac River Fisheries Commission to recover historical oyster bars and establish self-sustaining oyster reef sanctuaries in 20 key tributaries throughout the bay by the year 2020.
Ultimately, the states and federal government will need to figure out how to reduce runoff into the bay. That means paying more attention to farms, which are the single biggest sources of nutrient-laden water. But better farm practices alone won't do the job. In fact, Environmental Protection Agency official Chuck Fox says agricultural runoff has actually been improving somewhat.
This is contrary to urban and suburban runoff loads, which in fact are increasing in the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
So an effective strategy means getting states and local governments to pay more attention to new or rebuilt subdivisions and other development. Up until now, most of the bay's restoration plans have been largely voluntary, loosely coordinated by Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia, and the city of Washington, D.C., which are all in the bay's watershed. The new plan, ordered up this spring by President Obama, will give the federal government a much bigger role. Some in the region have worried this could amount to a federal takeover of the effort.
I would respectfully disagree with that characterization completely.
Again, Chuck Fox from the EPA.
It is our view that this is a new era of federal leadership, but it is also our view that we have to do this in close partnership with state and local governments as well as those in the private sector.
States are expected to come up with new regulations and measures to heal the bay, but if those fall short, the federal government will step in with new rules of its own. The plan is still in draft form. It is a big step up from the volunteer efforts of the past two decades. And Bill Dennison at the University of Maryland's Center for Environmental Science says it's a welcome one.
This is exciting times for Chesapeake Bay. It's kind of a supersized restoration program. And I think it represents an opportunity to take the best studied bay in the world into the best managed bay in the world.
One feature of the plan is that the states and federal government will review their progress every 2 years and not simply wait as the restoration deadline of 2025 draws near.
We have defined goals and measurable progress in realistic time frames. We're not talking about what we're going to do in 5 or 10 years outside the political life cycle of any particular politician, but we're talking about what we can do in a couple years.
Now, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation has been the region's leading advocate for restoring the bay. Roy Hoagland at the foundation says the newly unveiled plan lays out neatly all the things that need to be done, but he's not entirely happy.
What was disappointing about this federal strategy is the lack of specificity. For example, it talks about developing new regulations for better managing urban and suburban stormwater. It doesn't have any details of what that better management might or might not be.
Those all-important details still need to be worked out. Richard Harris, NPR News.